This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, another federal court ruling potentially affects elections in North Carolina. Protests in advance of a school board discussion over transgender students. The U.S. National Whitewater Center reopens its whitewater channels after a major cleanup. Controversy erupts at the state level over the cleanliness of drinking water in wells near coal ash ponds, raising questions about who's telling the truth. Donald Trump makes headlines in North Carolina with a statement some regard as an incitement to violence. Meanwhile, a lawsuit is filed by a former staffer in the North Carolina Trump campaign against the state campaign over the use of a gun. Our panel of reporters is ready to talk about these stories and more, and today we're joined by WFAE's Tom Bullock, who is back from vacation and will not be sharing his vacation photos until after the program has ended. Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Eric Frazier is editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to all of you as well.
Thank you. Good
you morning. Can reach us through email through CharlotteTalks at WFAE.org, on Facebook at WFAE, at CharlotteTalks on Twitter, and if you do Twitter, you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, on the heels of a court ruling that North Carolina voter ID laws were discriminatory and therefore unconstitutional, late yesterday, a federal three-judge panel ruled that the legislative districts drawn in 2011 for the North Carolina General Assembly are unconstitutional. Why?
Same reason. Race. Too much of a reliance on race to decide what the makeup of the districts are.
But in this case, it's almost the inverse of the first, because the court, I believe, said with regard to the voter ID laws that it was deliberately
disenfranchising
black voters. In this case, it was about drawing districts that were deliberately African American.
Well, it's actually a process that's called packing, and what that means is you pack a certain category of voter, whatever you choose, into specific districts. And before the redistricting in 2011, and it always happens after a census, you had nine districts, and these districts, to be clear, these are state legislative districts. You had nine state legislative districts that were predominantly African American. After the redistricting, you have 32. Now, that sounds at first like, hey, we're giving African Americans more of a voice in the General Assembly. But in reality, what packing does is it takes those voters away from other districts and concentrates them into just a few, in this case 32, and that dilutes their power to influence even more races. So this was designed to elect more Republicans. To elect more Republicans in the General Assembly. And that is, in fact, what it did. If you look at 2012, the year after the redistricting, the Republicans won 12 more seats in the General Assembly, and that gave them that veto-proof majority they still hold.
So it guarantees that African Americans pretty much will win in those districts but will most likely lose in all the others? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's basically sort of I hate to use the word, but it's sort of a ghettoization of minority voting power, just sort of segregating them into these specific districts so that they then don't have a chance to upset Republican, candidates.
And at the end of the day, it just makes all of the districts much less competitive.
Mm-hmm. So are we to believe then that in both these instances, movers and shakers in the legislature met behind closed doors and deliberately said, here's what we're going to do to disenfranchise African-American voters?
Well, they wouldn't put it that way.
No.
But I think in the voter ID case, it became pretty clear that they were fairly explicit that we are going to draw these districts in order to maximize Republican voting power. And I think what they felt was that it just so happens that most African Americans tend to vote Democratic. But that's not the thing that we're mainly looking at. And if that is a side effect that they wind up getting, their voting power is diluted by what we do, that's just a side effect, and that should be okay. But the judges at the Fourth Circuit said no.
Well, and in fact,
look at the boundaries of some of these districts. There's really no other explanation. I mean, they just defy any logic whatsoever. Some of them have little tiny enclaves that are almost cut off from the rest of the districts. And that just doesn't happen without intent.
Both of these laws changed after the federal government removed oversight and restrictions on North Carolina as having been habitually racially motivated in the past. And then along come these laws. Are we going to see them put us back on that list or recreate a list like that?
That list doesn't really exist any longer, because what happened is when the Supreme Court struck down a section of the Voting Rights Act, that's what you're referring to. So Congress would have to go back and pass a new law that would establish certain things. But the Voting Rights Act itself, it still exists. In fact, what the judges ruled here is that North Carolina legislatures, and this goes to your intent question, Mike, that they just misunderstood the Voting Rights Act. So, you know, the list is effectively dead. And that list is actually for any jurisdiction that had a history of deliberately disenfranchising minority voters. But it's not just the South.
But if we see a pattern of this in Wisconsin and in Texas and other places, if we start seeing patterns like this coming out and courts striking things down, are we likely to see Congress, particularly if there's a change in the makeup of Congress?
I was going to say, tell me what happens in November and I can give you an answer to that.
Because there is, I believe, a bill to sort of re-put the teeth back in the Voting Rights Act that's out there. It's just dead in the water. It hadn't gone anywhere.
And the other possibility, too, is a Supreme Court swing. If Hillary Clinton wins and she's able to get two or three judges on, who knows if the court will open that back up again.
Mm-hmm. Does this ruling yesterday afternoon impact the November election in North Carolina?
It does not. In fact, the judges stated specifically it is too late for the state to be able to redraw these maps, print out new ballots, identify the new voters, get the new you'd have to reopen filing periods for candidates, because obviously with new districts you can get new candidates.
But we did it during the primary.
But that was how long ago? That was a June primary. The November election gave them – there was still a whole lot of time. We're in August now. I spoke with North Carolina State Board of Elections to kind of say, okay, what is the process you have to go through here? It is actually a complicated process. It's not like you can just walk up to any polling place and get a ballot and vote. You have to be what's called geotagged in, and then again, they have to open the filing period to allow candidates to decide if they're going to run. Mm-hmm. There is not enough time for it to happen. So the judge is kind of, you know, came to a realization that they could effectively completely derail the state legislative election this year, and said, okay, you don't have enough time to do it before November. Therefore, this has to be done before the next election, which is 2018.
Why couldn't you move the election to December for the legislature?
You know, there's only one election that's mandated by the U.S. Constitution.
It's this one.
And that's the November election. Second Tuesday is law.
So the state asked the U.S. Supreme Court on Wednesday to reinstate the voter ID law that was, I think, overturned 2 weeks ago by a court. What was their argument, and where does that stand?
I think we're still waiting to hear what the Supreme Court says on that.
And I'll just be honest here. I'm not even certain yet that McCrory has – he said he will. I'm not certain it has actually been issued.
Okay.
That stay has been requested.
Because that does affect the November election. That's effectively immediately struck down all of those voter ID requirements. And yet Jim Morrill in The Observer reported that uncertainty continues to cloud the elections because of this ruling. The court was clear, I thought, on voter ID. They overturned it. They told the state to reinstate things the way they were. And yet evidently some counties, including Mecklenburg, are unclear about whether early voting hours will be reduced.
Well, they didn't specifically require that there be the same number, I think, of early voting hours there were in the last presidential election. And that was sort of an oversight on that court's part that has left, I think, a lot of – since the party in power chooses the county board of elections, and that's Republicans. So you have Republican-led county boards of elections that are now deciding the exactly how they're going to construct early voting.
Are we going to see a backlash? Are we going to see them try to subvert the court through their rulings?
You've already seen that in Guilford County, where they were going to try and cut back on the number of early voting hours, specifically in heavily minority voting precincts, and a crowd of people flooded their meeting at which they were thinking of doing that and protested, and they backed down.
Going back to your question, given the makeup of the Supreme Court in the absence of Scalia, it's very, very unlikely that that's going to get overturned. You basically have a 4-4 split now, and you might even argue that Roberts, you know, depending on which way he goes on this, could actually swing it in the other direction. But it's very unlikely the state's going to win this before the November election.
Well, the Attorney General Roy Cooper, correct me if I'm wrong, has said he will not defend the voter ID, the state against the voter ID ruling. Is that correct?
In part, and this again has become a pretty big point for the gubernatorial election. It was actually really fascinating. On Monday, I saw a story from WRAL-TV where they went through public data and saw that the state has spent something like $9 million defending these lawsuits. And the vast majority of that money has gone to voter ID. Now, the McCrory administration, and specifically the McCrory campaign and other Republican campaigns, continue to say that Democrat Roy Cooper, who is, of course, our serving attorney general as he's also running for governor, that money is necessary because he is not defending the law. He actually, or someone from his office, actually did defend the state in this case up to this ruling. And now he said the federal panel has ruled we will not. You know, we are not going to continue to defend,
okay.
Which is not an uncommon practice. But it's interesting to me because, you know, it seems with every point in this election, it all comes down to a tax and money. And both sides are raising money off of this. Both sides are attacking the other on this. And the reality is, you know, the federal panel has spoken. This is now the third time that a federal judge has come down with a ruling that directly affects North Carolina elections. This year alone,
right.
That is huge.
What, if anything, has he said about defending the state if they want to pursue, and they do want to pursue, this decision yesterday? What has he said about that?
I that's a great question. I haven't seen anything directly from it. I mean, you know, the key thing here is this also does not affect this election. So I'm not surprised to see both sides kind of just letting it be for the moment.
Right.
And, you know, what I'm waiting to see, I think a better question for this is simple. When the federal panel ruled on U.S. congressional districts in North Carolina, they ruled on two of them, right? They ruled that the 1st and the 12th were illegal racial gerrymanders. Everybody thought they would tweak the maps for those two, which would affect a couple others. In this case, there are 170 seats in the General Assembly, 120 in the House, 50 in the Senate. Only 28 of those districts have actually been ruled unconstitutional. I'm dying to see what the Republicans will do with those maps because I'm very curious to see if they implode it and just start over or just little tweaks.
That's a good question. I wonder that too. But I can't help but think, though, that when you start – all those districts and maps have all the parts interlock.
Right.
And if you pull one piece of the puzzle
other.
Out –
And I wonder if it's going to impact the 12th again, even though the 12th has been remedied. You're right. If once you start moving the pieces of that puzzle around, are we going to see redrawn?
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, the 12th. That's the U.S. House. Yeah, congressional.
Oh, yeah. You're right.
So these are separate from Congress. These are only state legislative districts,
right.
House and Senate.
Correct.
Correct. All right. When we come back from the break, we're going to talk about CMS's meeting this week over transgender students. I'm not sure that was meant to be a meeting about transgender students, but we'll talk about that and about the protests that occurred in advance of that meeting. And the Whitewater Center has reopened its channels. And Donald Trump has been here. He's coming here next week again, I believe. But he's been here in the state this week. And that made big news across the country, we all spent most of the week talking about this. We'll come back and talk about it some more on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and the Original Mattress Company, providing mattresses and bedding hand-built in the Charlotte factory and offered direct to the consumer. More info at originalmattress.com. Well, all of us love food. Most of us have favorite foods. And here's a shocker. Some of our favorites, like bread, chocolate, coffee, wine, are under threat. That's right, under threat. Due to changes in agriculture and the loss of agricultural biodiversity, the food chain is at risk. Think about this. 95% of the world's calories come from only 30 species. We're going to take a closer look at the problem and at some possible solutions on this program Monday at 9.
Mm-hmm. On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton deliver dueling economic speeches in Detroit. A Justice Department report finds systemic racial bias in the Baltimore Police Department. And new voter ID rulings in Wisconsin and Texas.
The News Roundup continues with the Diane Rehm Show from 10 to noon on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and that was a listener cover of our theme song. For a couple of weeks, we've been asking listeners to send in their takes on the theme, and that cover was by Samuel Flynn of Charlotte. It deserves to be played again. Play it again. See if they can do this up at the studio fast enough. They probably, oh my gosh, he's, there we go.
I like it.
Yeah, it's nice. All right, if for details on how to get your cover of our theme on the local news roundup, head to WFAE.org. Tom Bullock is here from WFAE News, along with Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com, and Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer. CMS was set to roll out a bathroom policy for transgender students that would have been at odds with HB 2. They decided to hold off on that, but on Tuesday, in advance of a board meeting, a protest broke out over that potential policy. If the policy is on hold, why did the North Carolina Values Coalition organize the protest in the rain?
I think the Values Coalition wants the school board to simply walk away from that policy altogether and not reestablish it, even if the ruling at the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, which has been, you know, has run counter to what the Values Coalition would like, and that's a case involving a transgender kid in Virginia who wanted access to the bathrooms corresponding with his gender identity, and that went against what the Values Coalition would have liked. But it's been appealed to the Supreme Court level, and it's been put on hold at the Supreme Court level. So CMS said, we will put our policy, which was in, you know, sort of in keeping with that Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals ruling, they would put theirs on hold. But the Values Coalition just wants them to walk away from it altogether.
I think there's even more than that, though. I mean, this is right before the start of the school year. This is a moment where it was a meeting where there was actually a point for public comment. So they just basically, you know, brought everybody there to try to make a point of it.
So, and it, frankly, wasn't on the it wasn't on the agenda, but it could have been brought up in the public comments.
And it was. In fact, it dominated the public comments meeting.
Yeah, they had been doing a letter-writing campaign trying to basically pressure the school board members into moving off of this position.
So speakers at the protest against the policy said that it violates student privacy, squelches communication with parents, and disregards gender assigned by God at birth. That was outside the meeting, but those complaints, as you said, moved inside. And the editorial board of the Observer called the North Carolina Values Coalition charge that the proposed rules put other students' privacy, safety, and dignity at risk nonsense.
Yeah.
That's a big word. Why?
Well, because they're saying that at heart what they're saying, and what has always been this criticism about HB2 or that sparked HB2, is that you're putting, if you allow transgender kids to have access to the bathroom of their gender identity instead of restricting them to the birth certificate bathroom, the bathroom corresponding with their birth certificate, that then you're going to have anatomical boys in the same bathrooms or locker rooms with girls, with anatomical girls. So that's bad, and that's putting these girls at risk. But what CMS has explicitly said is that they will, as a part of this policy, allow on request access to single stalls and, you know, sort of roped off or curtained off areas for privacy. So anyone who feels uncomfortable can get the privacy that they need to feel comfortable.
Meanwhile, school board chair Mary McCray opened that meeting on Tuesday with criticism of people who she said had spread misinformation about the plan, and gave people 1 minute as opposed to the normal 3 minutes to speak. I have questions about why on both counts. Why start with the criticism and then why limit conversation to one when the normal time is three? Did that inflame the situation?
I think she may have, I wouldn't have. Some of the things that were said afterwards, you can kind of see why she did that, because some of these speakers were, man, they were really
fire and brimstone.
Oh, wow. They were really going in hard and, you know, calling people out by name when you're not supposed to do that and, you know, damning people to hell. You're all going to hell and, you know, that kind of thing. But at the same time, the rule is the rule, and you can't start just sort of arbitrarily picking, you know, instances where, well, I'm going to curtail public comment on this because I don't like what they're going to say.
Yeah.
That's a bad policy.
And the trick is, like, take the Charlotte City Council for really contentious meetings like the original ordinance. There are more than 140 speakers. They cut their public comment time from 3 minutes to 2 minutes because they just wanted to try to get through everyone and not have the meeting last until 4 a.m. So to have it, you know, it doesn't matter whether you agree or disagree. The point is, if it's a publicly elected body and it's time for public comment, that should be respected.
And I think it's time that they really review those rules, especially I understand not wanting to call out an individual teacher or whatever. But under those rules, you can't even criticize a school board member. And if you're an elected official, you should, you know, that's kind of thin-skinned, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Did she explain which rules that she felt had been misrepresented by the protesters?
She was talking, apparently, about this. There were some presentation materials that the CMS presentation materials that were going to principals. It looked like a PowerPoint or something that would help the principals in terms of they were training the principals about how to implement this new bathroom policy or anti-bullying policy, of which the bathroom thing was a piece. And the Values Coalition got a hold of this presentation, and they in part of it, it also has like this little cartoon character.
Yeah, the famous CMS unicorn.
The gender unicorn, as people were calling it. And so they basically, the Values Coalition, took the presence of this cartoon character and this training as a sign or a signal that CMS was about to try and implement this policy to sort of brainwash kids into accepting transgender and LGBT rights.
Yeah, and that's where it really got tricky. Like Franklin Graham was there, and Franklin Graham compared this to the brainwashing of communists. Yeah. Like, you know, back in during the Cold War, it's a kind of inflammatory rhetoric, to say the least, that is really... Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because the only thing I know about what happened at that meeting was what I read in the paper, in which I was told that she told Mary McCrae, the school board chair, told the audience there that there has not ever been and will not be a plan or curriculum for CMS students or transgender issues.
She repeated it twice to make sure.
What you just said moments ago changes the light of that comment for me. But why wouldn't there be? If they're going to change the policy and they're going to have
a
bathroom
question
for kids who identify as transsexual, why wouldn't you, in an educational setting, have education for the other kids to help understand these kids who are transsexual?
That's a fair question.
Yep.
But I think the school board is, that's a hot potato they don't want to handle.
Okay. One item that was on the agenda and which also holds the potential of great controversy is phase one of a developing plan to deal with breaking up pockets of poverty in the school system. They're beginning with magnets, and they were set to consider a plan that would make the magnet lottery less random and which would take into account socioeconomic status. Did that discussion, was it given any time or traction in the meeting? Did they resolve anything?
I'm not sure of that. I was so taken by all the gender unicorn stuff that I couldn't miss that part.
it is progressing. It's not like it's done. Our colleague Lisa Wharf did a really interesting interview on this earlier this week. And the whole idea is how do you – you know, lotteries are by definition supposed to be random. And when it comes to magnets, how do you adjust it to get the right student set? And you just make it less random. So now they're talking about, as you said, the socioeconomic piece, you know, de-emphasizing, re-emphasizing certain areas, trying to get a mix that's really more of like, you know, 30% kids who fall under the poverty line, 30% middle income, 30% high income. And the whole goal, it sounds like, is just to keep to that. No school should have more than 70% of their population, their student population, be from, you know, be at or below the poverty line, because that statistics have shown seems to be the breaking point for the schools in the system. That's where the quality tends to go down.
Okay, moving on. After
apparently I bored you.
No, I'm just waiting. I want to get ahead so that we can see your vacation picture. After being closed for a month or so, the U.S. National Whitewater Center reopened their whitewater channels this
Woo-hoo!
Week. As we all remember,
excited.
But as we all remember, a visitor died from an infection from a brain-eating amoeba, which she came into contact with at the center. And they closed the channels. They drained the water. They spent weeks trying to figure out how to clean the water before they drained it. And then now that it's been drained, they cleaned the channels. And there you go. However, last week there was still some question about what cleanliness standards would be going forward and who would set them and what entity would regulate it. Has any of that been resolved?
No. Not at all.
So it's open and running.
Yeah, but it with some significant new steps. I mean, the reality is for standards to be set, it has to be set by Mecklenburg County, first of all, but Mecklenburg County wants to defer to the state. Well, the state legislature is not back in session until January. Mm-hmm. So there's nothing quite yet. But the Whitewater Center has been working with, you know, county regulators, the CDC, basically all kinds of experts to try to figure this out. Because the thing about this brain-eating amoeba is, first of course it sounds frightening. And if you get the infection, it is. But the amoeba is incredibly common in water
fresh
sources.
Water.
Yeah. And the infection is incredibly rare. So you have a much higher chance of, you know, dying. I can't even count the number of ways. This is, I think it's like 4 people on average a year.
And it has to
this.
Go up your nose.
Yeah.
If you drink the water, nothing's going to happen.
So what the Whitewater Center did is they just fell back on a classic system, which is chlorine. And they'd already used chlorine to clean the water, but they're changing the way they do it to try to make sure that it doesn't get
– Well, the Whitewater Center has said for years – and the problem with this is a unique facility. Mm-hmm. It was the first of its kind. Mm-hmm. Nobody knew really what to do, but they put in what they thought was a state-of-the-art system to clean the water with chlorine and UV rays and mm-hmm. things like that. But kayakers, in retrospect, have been complaining about getting out of that water and being covered with, I don't know what you call it, but
gunk.
And that would have been a red flag to me that the system wasn't working. So what are they doing differently now?
I dropped by there last week as they were filling up the channels, and I can tell you the chlorine smell, when you got there, you could tell. Mm-hmm. And that's a smell that I didn't recall previously. But it smelled like an indoor pool where you walk in and there's a strong chlorine smell when you got close to the channels in the water.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, they're putting more chlorine in.
Because it's more than a pool. It's not just a swimming pool. It's a moving water channel, and things fall into the moving water mm-hmm. channel because it's outdoors.
Correct.
And people get in the channel, and pieces of the kayak probably get into the channel. So what are they doing differently to clean the water, aside from adding more chlorine to the water? Do we know?
That's it. And that the CDC, the Whitewater Center, and every doctor that's behind this says should be enough. Because here's the thing again, this is an incredibly common amoeba. The infection is the rare part.
Right.
So it's not like they found this strange superbug growing here.
And yet, just I think it was last week, another person, this time in South Carolina, contracted this amoeba and died. And they came into contact with it in a regular open body of water.
Yeah.
Is this just coincidence, or is this something that we can blame on climate change and increased water temperatures?
I don't think it's that, because in some cases it's going to change it. I'm going to focus on this. Let's talk shark attacks.
Okay.
How many shark attacks happen? Every summer, it seems like there's a sudden jump in shark attacks. The reality of it is the statistics are still pretty rare. Your odds of getting bitten by a shark are really, really, really low. But, you know, once you start reporting on it, the media kind of gloms onto it, including us, and therefore you keep getting more and more.
Right. Okay, on Tuesday, while speaking at a rally in Wilmington, Donald Trump made a statement that, like many of his off-the-cuff remarks, strikes some as horrifying and supporters as, oh, that Donald.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick, her judges, nothing you can do, folks.
Now, even the
although
crowd,
the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But
okay, I almost stepped on the key phrase there. I'm sorry about that. Even the crowd there had mixed reactions: some cheers, some boos, some silence from others. Was Trump, as he insists, referring to the political power of gun rights advocates or inciting violence against another presidential candidate?
I think, like Paul Ryan said, it was a joke, a bad joke that shouldn't have been told that went bad.
Yeah. I don't think he was trying to incite violence, but it was highly irresponsible, especially in this climate.
Patty Reagan has reacted negatively to this because her father was the last president who was the victim of a potential assassin's bullet, and she found it remarkably offensive.
Well, and, I mean, I agree with Eric. I agree with Paul Ryan. I do think this was a joke gone bad, and that is not a justification. When you're a presidential candidate for a major political party in one of the most contentious elections in modern history, you don't get to make jokes like that. Glenn's right. It is irresponsible, and it's part of a pattern. You know, it's fascinating because bad jokes in politics are called gaffes. Calls that say basically that this is, he was actually just trying to get Second Amendment people to vote, that's called spin. And the reality is, if you go back to his comments, he was clearly talking about Hillary Clinton as president, not before she becomes that. Mm-hmm. So this was not
And Pat McCrory was in the audience, and I kept wondering, I wonder what his reaction to that was. And he initially, and reporters were chasing him around trying to get his reaction, and it took a couple of days, but he eventually said that, he thought that it was not a big deal, reporters are making too much of it, blah, blah, blah. And he's also tired of answering for everything that comes out of Trump's mouth.
I can't remember who I heard say this. I think it was a member of the Kennedy family that said this, that when President Kennedy had his famous news conferences, he was a member of the Kennedy family. When President Kennedy had his famous news conferences, he did a lot of off-the-cuff remarks to reporters, which were generally pretty funny. And it was unique for the time because he was the first president to do that. When Robert Kennedy spoke in, I think, Indianapolis, the night that Martin Luther King was killed, he spoke completely off the cuff. And he quelled what was going to be a riot in that city because of his off-the-cuff remarks. Mm-hmm. And the comment was that the reason for bringing up those examples was that off-the-cuff remarks show the person, the real person. Not these scripted, teleprompter-aided speeches, but what you say in your unguarded moments shows who you are. What is this revealing about these candidates?
I agree completely. Eric referred to it as a joke. I'm not sure it was a joke. I think it was just more thoughtless, and I think that's what it says about Donald Trump, that he's often thoughtless.
We'll come back with more on this and down-ballot reaction to the Donald Trump comment in just a moment. It's Charlotte Talks, the weekly local news roundup on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and doctors making house calls, serving patients in their home or workplace. All insurance accepted. Registration information available at doctorsmakinghousecalls.com. Never wait in a doctor's office again. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton give dueling economic speeches in Michigan. A Justice Department report finds systemic racial bias in the Baltimore Police Department. And new voter ID rulings in Wisconsin and Texas. Those are just some of the topics they'll be talking about as the weekly news roundup continues on the Diane Rehm Show, the national hour at 10, the international hour at 11. And if you'd like to join us on our conversation about local news, Charlotte Talks at WFAE.org will get to you, or you can search for WFAE on Facebook or get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. We're coming right back.
David Porter of Hendrick Acura, a WFAE underwriter.
Businesses more and more have to keep engaged with your clients and figure out a way to keep them coming back. WFAE seems to have that figured out. We have seen that WFAE has almost a lifetime loyalty among the listeners. We hear that on a regular basis.
For more information, email underwriting@wfae.org.
It's Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, along with Eric Frazier, editorial writer for the Charlotte Observer, Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News, and Glenn Birkins, editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com. Let's talk some more about reaction to Donald Trump's comment, which we played a moment ago. You mentioned you were curious about what Pat McCrory had to say, because I think he was in the audience listening to that. But what about people like Richard Burr? He said he was surprised. Opponent Deborah Ross said the comments were dangerous and making him unfit to be commander-in-chief. Now, this is interesting, because earlier Richard Burr said he soundly condemned Trump's comments about Khazir Khan, the Gold Star father who lost his son in Afghanistan and who spoke about him at the Democratic Convention. So is it simply an easier thing and more valuable thing to condemn, or is that last statement, the one that we played, more open to interpretation?
That he was embarrassed, you mean?
No, the Donald Trump statement. Is it easier to condemn Donald Trump for his Khazir Khan comments versus one that could be interpreted as either being an invitation to share a presidential candidate?
I don't know. I think the second comment, the first comment deserved the reaction from Burr that it got. The second one, I think, probably deserved the same kind of reaction because, you know, that's just not something to be talking about loosely.
You know? How do you explain Republicans nationally and in this state, for that matter, who are still supporting Donald Trump in light of all these gaffes and comments that are being taken by certain people as being dangerous?
It boils down to a simple phrase. He's our party's nominee. There are a lot of things that forces.
But the Republican Party has traditionally wrapped itself in the American flag, and they're the patriots and the Democrats are not. So how can they be patriots if they are going to willfully and willingly post a candidate they even admit is dangerous?
Sometimes? I heard someone explain it this way, that they're betting that Donald Trump is a stain on the party, not a tattoo. And that after this election, they're going to be able to wash off that stain. They don't believe he's going to have some long-lasting effect or damage to the party.
Even if he's elected?
I don't know about that.
Well, I'm not making that argument.
I'm just saying that this was one explanation,
and that they feel that if they can hold the party together and get through this election, that they can wash that stain off.
But I think you're going to have, if the polls hold as they are right now with Trump losing pretty badly, you're at the end of this election cycle, you're going to have, there were 14 million Republican voters who voted for Donald Trump in the primaries. You're going to have 14 million angry, disillusioned, disappointed Republican-based voters.
Who have been told by their candidate that the election is probably rigged.
Yeah, and that's going to be a problem primarily for the GOP, but for the, for the country generally.
Yeah.
But what does the GOP do with those people? That's going to be a big question.
I'm not sure the GOP gets to pick what they do. I mean, the reality is that's the danger of this election. That's the danger when we have these kinds of comments. And that's the reality that win or lose we'll have to look for and, frankly, we'll be covering, I'm sure, come mid-November.
It was reported that Georgia, which is a traditionally Republican state, is moving more into the Democratic camp. And speaking of that, we have a question from a listener, Hannah, who asks, if states like Georgia have moved from solidly Republican in the presidential race to potentially winnable by Hillary Clinton, why is North Carolina still such a toss-up? Why isn't North Carolina polling more strongly for Mrs. Clinton?
It's a great question, but it assumes something, which is that Georgia is already in the Democratic camp. The reality is in 2008, everybody was stunned when Barack Obama won North Carolina by less than 1%. In 2012, he lost it to Mitt Romney by less than 2%. And even though our state legislature, just like Georgia, is deep, deep dark red, North Carolina is truly now a battleground state, a real battleground state. Georgia, I think in both polls, at least the polls I've seen recently, and again, these are still early polls. We're 90 days out. Lots can change. But, in both cases, Clinton is leading Trump by a very slim margin, but still is largely in that margin of error. And that is true here as well. So it's a great question, but the reality is it's that the states are being – they are similar, that in fact everything is still pretty close. Georgia surprises me, but North Carolina being a toss-up does not.
Well, a public policy polling reports that Hillary Clinton is leading in North Carolina by a narrow margin for the first time since March, 43-41%. But it also says that Trump, already unpopular, has become even more so. Further, the poll says that voters would prefer a continuation of the Obama administration to Trump's vision for the country by 50-45%. Does that surprise anybody?
Well, no, not given that President Obama's approval ratings are rising. I guess as people get a look at the options for replacing him, he's looking a lot better to people now.
So when Donald Trump says what you're going to get with Hillary Clinton is 4 more years of President Obama, he's defeating himself by saying that?
I've never thought the Democrats have done a good job, and not just recently, but throughout history, recent history at least, making a good case for themselves.
Right, they never have.
If you look at our national economy by any objective measure, we are infinitely better off now than we were in 2008.
Sure.
So we should be praying, whether Donald Trump is elected or whether Hillary Clinton's elected, we should be praying that we continue.
Well, then why are there so many angry people out there who feel they have been left behind by this?
That's the one economic indicator that does not show us being infinitely better. The numbers do. Glenn, you're right. But the consumer sentiment, the feeling, that gut check for people is not there. And that's the point. That was the core of the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's the core of the Trump campaign. That is very much at heart, at stake at this election. And it does go in the face of numbers.
I think there are a lot of things that contribute to that. I think part of that is just a general anxiety about the shifting of our nation, the shifting in the demographics, shifting in the values. If you look at what we've talked about today, we've not been talking about how to move the country or even the state forward. We've been talking about hot-button issues, about transgender rights, mm-hmm. Voter disenfranchisement, things like that.
And why is that, no pun intended, trumping conversation about things that matter to the pocketbook?
Because those things move voters. They're easier to understand. They're more gut issues. It's easier to get someone riled up about transgender rights than to go into a deep conversation about how the economy works and trade and all that.
I think we're doing that a bit with the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the whole fight about trade. I mean, trade has been a major point for both presidential campaigns. And even on a state level, the debate over whether or not there has been a Carolina comeback is dominating the gubernatorial race.
Yeah.
So, economic policy is still there, but I do think you're right that it's about a gut feeling. And it's interesting because it's this humans are animals, and we often do go with our gut and go with our feeling. And there are a lot of people who do not feel that they are doing better now than they were before.
That public policy poll also reports that races across the state are tight, with Roy Cooper leading Pat McCrory 43-42%, and with 58% believing that HB2 is hurting the state. But in the Senate race, it's not so close. Richard Burr leads Deborah Ross 41-37%. I guess that is close. Is that close?
That's pretty close.
Yeah,
given,
that's just outside the margin
of error.
That's close.
Yeah.
So do these numbers mean anything at this stage of the game?
They're good for political junkies.
Okay. Meanwhile, a former Charlotte staff member for the Trump campaign, Vincent Bordini, has filed a lawsuit against the campaign and against Earl Phillip, who I think was the leader of the campaign, alleging that Trump's then state director pulled a gun on him and campaign officials refused to do anything about it. What do we know about this situation, this instance?
I don't know a whole lot, except that it just signals some of the disorganization.
They
were riding in Phillips' Jeep.
Right.
A weird incident.
And he pulls a gun and puts it on his kneecap.
Puts it on his knee.
It's loaded. The safety is off.
And I wasn't clear if they were having a disagreement or what. Was it done in anger?
All we know is from the court documents, and obviously those are one-sided. And Bordini said that it came out of nowhere. They were riding along. Phillip pulled out the gun, jammed it into his knee, you know, Bordini complained, shall we say, and then Philip put it away like it was no big deal. But I actually called Earl Philip yesterday to try to get a comment. He referred me to his lawyer, and his lawyer said, what you would expect, this is defamation. This did not happen. We are going to countersue for defamation of character.
Allegations that it happened four other times to four other people.
Again, made by the same court document. And I'm not diminishing that. I just want to make sure that it's clear that all the details we have are from one side.
And is Philip still with the Trump campaign?
He is not.
Although he still says he's an ardent supporter of Donald Trump. There's been controversy, which is really puzzling. I keep reading these articles over and over again, trying to read between the lines and trying just to come to some basic understanding of what's going on with this argument over the health of our drinking water in these wells around coal ash ponds. First, the state issued a statement saying the water was unsafe to drink. Then it flipped on that. That has led to two resignations by scientists.
One resignation. Dr. Ken Rudow still works for the state.
Okay. Well, you say that none of this bodes well for Pat McCrory, Eric, who has said that this is just a dispute among scientists, and he accused one of them, the one that still works for the state, of lying under oath.
Well, yeah, I mean, the last thing he needs right now when he's in a fight for his political life is anything that reaffirms the old narrative of him as the, you know, veteran former Duke Energy employee doing or saying anything that would, you know, help Duke Energy with its coal ash unduly help them. Yes. Mm-hmm. And if you listen to what Ken Rudow, who's this state toxicologist, says, you know, it's kind of hard not to come away with that impression if you believe what he said in his deposition testimony, which is that he got hauled into the governor's office after he voiced concern that appointees or McCrory's aides were trying to get him to water down his concerns and his warnings about the safety of the water around those wells.
And he alleges that the governor made a phone call during that meeting, but the governor says he took no part in that meeting.
Well, again, it's a matter of semantics. I think it's not disputed that the governor called in to
That's
his
correct.
Office at the time that that meeting was going on. Now, what were they talking about?
Okay.
I don't know.
Meanwhile, that has led to the resignation of the state's chief epidemiologist, who is this man, Rudow's boss. She resigned this week saying that she could no longer work for a department or an administration that misleads the public.
Yeah, and I think that's the most damning and damaging thing of all that's unfolded here so far about this, because the McCrory administration was basically painting Rudow as kind of a lone rogue scientist who was out there, you know, doing his own thing and, you know, inappropriately telling people that there were dangers when there weren't.
They've called him a fearmonger.
Yeah, basically. And now his boss comes out and resigns a $188,000 a year job and says, you guys are basically full of it. You guys being McCrory and company. And, you know, it's kind of hard to spin that one.
So McCrory has said that this is a disagreement among scientists. Here we have two scientists who are in complete agreement. So who are the scientists who disagree with them?
That is one of the stranger parts of this whole saga. The scientists that he is choosing to go with are the Federal Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA. And this is a moment where Pat McCrory is running and wrapping his arms around President Barack Obama's administration. It's always a strange thing to see. What they did is they found the state, those you know, Dr. Ken Rudow, Dr. Megan Davies, the former top epidemiologist, and a couple of others set a standard for this carcinogen that
hexavalent
chromium.
Okay.
That is in the water. That state standard was mandated by law, and they set a pretty tight level on it after looking at it.
Yeah, the coal ash management law.
Exactly. What the McCrory administration officials did is they went out and found a much more forgiving standard that's an older standard that was set by the EPA quite some time ago. And they said, oh, well, the feds say that's okay, so we're going to go with
it. And the motivation for that would be what?
That is up for interpretation in the entire heart of this controversy.
Am I wrong in saying that in those situations where the state initially said the water is unsafe to drink, that those people are still being supplied either bottled water or city water.
Well, not city water. They're still being supplied bottled water by Duke Energy because Duke says, A, it's being just a good neighbor, and B, state law requires they do it until municipal water is built out to those sites.
Doesn't that sound odd to you?
Again, I'm going to leave that up to interpretation.
Okay. Speaking of water, some of the swimming pools at the Olympics have turned green.
That's really weird.
And some of the swimmers have been turning green with envy when it comes to the U.S. swim team. And one of those swimmers, Kathleen Baker, won silver in the 100-meter backstroke on Monday. She is from Charlotte. Ryan Lochte moved here in 2013. Swimmac's oldest swimmer, 35-year-old Anthony Irvin, also in Rio. How much of this has to do with Charlotte's Swimmac Swim Club, which has been an attraction for serious athletes for some time now?
They're a powerhouse.
They've got six athletes.
Six.
And a coach.
And a great coach. I mean, and they are a powerhouse. And I have to say, like, I have a daughter. She's 5 years old. Mm-hmm. She's in daycare right now. But if you're listening, Charlie, I'm saying hi. I watched the race that you're talking about, the silver medal, where she won the silver medal. And when I told my daughter that that is a girl from Charlotte, you should have seen her eyes light up. And that's the power of the Olympics. You know, it's fun. They're incredible athletes. But I'll tell you what, they can inspire. And it's sorry for the personal anecdote, but I just love to share it.
But you got these people training at the Whitewater Center.
Yep.
You've got the Swimmac folks. You've got Tavis Bailey, grew up in Kannapolis, who's an alternate on the women's gymnastics team. Ashton Locklear from Huntersville, the U.S. coach of the head coach of the U.S. women's swim team is from Swimmac. Mike Krzyzewski's coaching the basketball team. What is it about North Carolina and the Olympics? We'll hold the answer to that question until the local news roundup next week. Thank you all.